Now we know.
So how much time do we have? Or?
Most of them have been about an hour and a half. Something in that, an hour 15. Alejandra Aravena and Michael Meredith went on for almost 2 hours.
Right.
Which was because Michael was trying to get Alejandra to admit. Have you heard Alejandra lecture?
No.
He always speaks about his work in terms of just economic and practical inevitability.
Right.
It's just like the minimum thing it has to be. And Michael was trying to nail him to the floor on that and say, absolutely not.
Right.
So it was a really fun conversation. But,
do we know his work?
No, did he do this like in Outhouse?
He did the Siamese Towers, and he just finished that dorm in Texas. If you haven't seen it, you have to see it. The brickwork on it is unbelievable.
He's with One of Ix?
No.
Oh, mm-hmm. I thought you said the One of Ix was doing that thing with brickwork.
No.
Okay.
No, you want coffee?
Right. I'm fine.
Okay.
It's beautiful.
Okay.
And it's, you know, again, it's all like, oh, well, it's just that it was the cheapest thing possible, and, you know, it's because it's in Texas, Mexican labor, but, you know, it's this complete...
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but when you look at it, it's... He's like, oh, we just let the Masons do what they're good at.
Right.
How good.
Then I think...
what are we doing wrong then?
Yeah,
can I...
Never let the Masons...
So we should all say who we are for the transcriber, too. So.
Poor transcriber.
This is Amal Andraus.
And this is Dan Wood.
This is Mark Poon.
So, shoot.
All right.
And by the way, I'm just
Ashley
here
Schaefer
as...
Here too.
Yes, but I'm just here as sort of chaperone and to... Yeah. Occasional provocateur if I feel like things aren't getting pushed quite far enough to push them a little further.
Okay.
But basically, I'm silent.
The first question is... first of all, we love your work, so we can start there so that there's no... We just watched an hour of the lecture, and it was really great to see the stuff. So, but maybe then the first question is not, and it's been, I think, up in the air these days around, I would say, especially American academia. It's not so much in terms of the work, but how we speak about it. Mm-hmm. And we are very partial to the way you present your work because there's affinity. I think we tend to present the work in the same way. Mm-hmm. We looked at a set of issues. We kind of identified how we wanted to frame the problem, and that resulted in in something. But we also don't believe in the inevitability of form. I mean, we are very conscious that it's a level of interpretation, and we could take the same, building codes or the same data, and then we would probably come up with something quite different.
Even with the same argument, probably.
No, I know, but isn't that part of the trick that you would actually kind of make it sound as if there is that one almost like this line of thing that automatically almost leads to that? I mean, it's kind of seems to be like the common strategy in like architectural presentation. Obviously, it's not the case at all.
Right. So then the question is, and it may be because we haven't found a way to articulate, because us, we're unhappy with the ways things were framed, let's say, a generation ago, so we're trying to find new ways to talk about the work, but maybe haven't found it. And, so we're curious, if you weren't talking at that level, how else would you talk about the work? Because when you look at the work, there's definitely an interest in reinterpreting typologies, and I think even formally, there's a sensibility to... sort of more kind of angled shapes, and it's really about distorting almost known types rather than. So I would like you to elaborate. Like if you were forbidden from which we use and abuse, and then you could say no, sorry, I can't, and that would be fine. I think I'm just curious because it's something that we've been thinking about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's curious. I mean, I do definitely think that issues like, for example, like existing typologies and all these kinds of things play in, which probably also have to do with the past teaching. I've been teaching actually typologies in Aachen in Germany, which, I mean, you have to understand the academic system works quite different. You know, there's different chairs. One is looking into typologies, but it was always the question, even there, the problem of like, how, I mean, does that even exist as a like a one-to-one model? Obviously, you need to question them, but at the same time, they contain a certain degree of intelligence because they have evolved over a certain time. So there is some information embedded into them already. So I do definitely, I think that's totally right. I do definitely like to look at those and take them on again or reread them. But I think just completely leaving these behind, I find that almost a little bit naive in a sense, because I cannot believe that there is not like an accumulated amount of intelligence into them and in those actually. So what that means in the way for an alternative way of presenting those, I think that would very much depend on the context. If I would present it in Germany or here or in Chile, in Germany I would never go into the typological route. I think because it's like one of the big traps anywhere. Anyways, over there in terms of like really being stuck in some of these patterns, like being kind of the typological one, the one of means of how do you actually construct. I mean, it's not a surprise that a magazine like Detail comes from Germany in that sense. But it's the way they think and argue about it is in a very compartmentalized way. So in that sense, I would answer that it really depends on where I would present
it.
I kind of like the idea to go here in the U.S. I mean, it's kind of a devil's advocate in a way, right? If I presented it at SciArt, for example, like I would definitely introduce these things to it because, I mean, that's like something that's outside, I mean, from my perspective at least, outside a certain pattern that things are discussed within. And so I think suddenly it introduces like another reading to it.
So it's more at the level of a performance when you give a lecture where you would strategize in relation to the how you're reading the audience.
I think so, yeah.
Fair enough.
That's something you guys have done too, huh?
Change. I mean, we know our audiences, yeah. Sometimes.
No, but I mean, you mentioned that, and if you really don't want this on tape,
we want it on tape.
But that you guys had worked with acting coaches.
Because if we're presenting, that's primarily for clients. But I mean, we are. We've learned a lot
as a performance.
Yeah, and it's actually all unlearning architectural presentation. So you don't. Anyway, it's all. But you don't look at the slides. You keep the lights on. You don't use images to tell a story. You tell the story with the words.
But is there a whole alternative story? Like, if you really, in terms of like talking about the project or the proposal itself, is there a whole alternative story? Or like, where do they meet? Yeah, the client story and the kind of student lecture story or the.
It's not a whole alternative story. It's just what you highlight of it. And it's more. It's exactly the same thing. I mean, if you're doing a presentation, a lecture, and it's a good lecture, you're supposed to. It's more interesting if you have some kind of argument, I think, and so you construct. You know, you're supposed to construct the lecture not. Well, we are guilty of this too, but not project by project, but with trying to find maybe one question or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would be the kind of more. Classical way of presenting a lecture. So in the same sense, you would present your work to clients with the same strategy. What is the client looking? What is that presentation or that interview focusing on? And so you kind of reorient the work to kind of create a narrative that answers the questions that you know or you're imagining they're looking for. The main difference, I think, is literally about our body language and the way we as architects tend to get proof through images and visuals, but of course visuals don't prove anything, they don't exist, right? I mean, they're an image, like what you project with your body is an image. So from the point of view of performance, what you project with your body and your voice and your eyes is much more powerful, according to certain studies, you know, theatrical studies than what you project visually. So it's a different thing.
Right.
You know, when you're at school and then students gesture with their hands and say, I want to do a beam, and you don't gesture with your hands, draw it. You know, and then,
right.
Of course, for a presentation, you're supposed to gesture with your hands.
Right.
So anyway.
It's a different, yeah.
But I think that's a really interesting question to be kind of to reform. I think Liz Diller had a TED talk or something where she went through and kind of presented, I think, Lincoln Center, you know, in different ways,
mm-hmm.
Depending on whether she thought she was talking to an academic circle or the client. Mm-hmm. So then maybe, I mean, just to close and come back to what you were saying about the question between Michael and Alejandro is, maybe we should separate, right? There's the work and then there's the performance as your lecturer, and the way you talk about the work, and those are really, and then maybe those are really completely different. Or maybe one allows you to find out more about the other. Have you found a difference in the way that you lecture, like whether it's here or in other places?
Do you get
a sense that there's a wide, that the audience is really widely different still? Or?
I think it's actually quite interesting that, I mean, it's not like so much like a thing between, like a continental thing, you know, between the European or the North American, the South American. It's more kind of that there's families of schools, actually. I mean, certainly, like, from my own experience, SciArc has specific ties to schools in Europe, but then there's like certain ones that are like in a very different kind of framework of mm-hmm. thinking or approaching. I'm not quite sure if I would go that far that I would completely separate. The one is just a performance in terms of but I think it's actually quite interesting to put yourself into that kind of a spiel to rethink it on all the different terms or along all these different lines. And it's hard to prove, but I would assume that it's quite an interesting way or a productive way for oneself to actually come to new territories with what you're doing in a way.
Yeah, I think so.
But I think I want to just bring it back to the formal question a little bit, which is like, I mean, say, would, I mean, just because we're interested in it too, but, you know, say someone read your work as a kind of continuing exploration of the moment at which a roof becomes a wall, you know, which I think is a kind of running theme mm-hmm. through many projects. And say, you know, I mean, is it... does it make you... I feel a little bit uncomfortable when someone says, you know, tries to frame our work in, say, purely formal mm-hmm. terms. And, you know, I mean, so what... Like, say you were asked to present your entire project through research like that, or through a kind of exploration of the formal qualities of angled surfaces or something.
Okay. Well, with the angled surface, I would definitely have an issue, because I don't think it holds true for all the projects. Also, I don't find it... it's hard for me to find, like, a way to actually discuss that or explore it properly. But I think the exploration of saying, which I haven't done, but like to say there's like a common thread would be to explore these,
taking a roof, a wall becomes a roof.
Exactly. Right. Like anywhere around there, I think there's a series of implications suddenly in there, or just even taking exploration. I mean, I would even go like just taking the wall as a thing and taking that into, I mean, taking that literally apart. So I think there's suddenly like a whole universe that opens up in terms of spatial organization. I mean, suddenly, like, you know, you're in the discussion of what the wall house does, for example, as something that was not, I mean, not so much originally designed as like this classic plan layout, where does this go? Suddenly, if you start splitting up different layers with their performative, with their environmental mm-hmm. properties, with the way they create specific climate zones at the end, I think.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you are trying to like reorganize living in a way, or at least from my perspective, and try to get hit a different terrain or go somewhere else with the way you operate from just, you know, how do you organize different parts of living according to a plan. And then I think you can make it quite interesting. I would not be uncomfortable at all, actually, to discuss it along these lines.
Yeah.
And then once you're in the realm of climate zones, it might, you know, lead you even off track to any of the... of any of the other projects, potentially.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that I would feel completely comfortable with, because it opens up a whole realm on...
Which you are really dealing with, I mean, in your work, right? You're peeling the wall horizontally, or you're kind of stretching it vertically to...
You mean the Wallhouse project, or...?
Yeah, the Wallhouse, and then the other one, the...
The House in Heat, no? Which one?
Yeah, the House in Heat, and, I mean, it's really a kind of operation on the skin, but... As a thickened skin, or a stretched skin, or a...
Yeah, in the one sense, I mean, in the one case, probably, as it turns into, like, a series of really thin ones, almost, but each in-between zone becoming inhabitable, and the other one, it literally... thickens up in a way, but I mean, I think I have to say, like, I have a great interest also in residential environment, because I actually think it's like one of the most complex ones, and the idea of that you could reframe the one issue, I mean, if you could ever claim it to be the one issue, but reframe it every single time, and But what becomes interesting at some point, at least in the two projects you were mentioning, is like when suddenly, like, the way let's say the way we inhabit or co-inhabit with other people or and so on, the way we live together suddenly overlaps with an idea of an environmental scheme for the house. But that all these kinds of things kind of suddenly merge into like one larger kind of strategy, you know, where they're not separable from one another. Mm-hmm. And I think that's also one of the aspects that binds the two projects together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I think that's like also one of the big issues right now, that they're always like, you basically put the green brush over a
part. Right, right.
And so, like, one of these critical challenges is like, the climate onion kind of thing with the peeling. So how is there any way for that to actually form a different sort of architectural or spatial language? And I mean it's more an ongoing investigation, as if more so than really finding clear answers.
That's very clear, and maybe that takes me to the second question, which is the issue of form and performance. And how you especially as it relates to systems, I think it's quite fascinating now to be, you know, how do you express systems and can you use them in a kind of productive way is it important I'm thinking, because, you know, for me, Germany is the ultimate kind of performing place, right?
You're watching too much advertising.
Yeah, maybe, but I know that in the US we don't come close. I mean, do you, for example, is it important to for the houses to really perform at an environmental level, or is it the image of performance awareness and the?
No, I'm not. I think I would like definitely not be. The image of performance seems like a really difficult thing. I mean, I would not want to go there, actually. But the question, first of all, like, how would you define architectural performance? Because I think it's quite different from engineering performance, and that's why, you know.
Yeah.
So we're not making a. We're not interested in that part so much. Even in some ways it plays into it, but I mean, what is ultimately like architectural performance? I don't know if I could like really easily answer that question right now, but it's again like probably it's the same question of like why it's a little bit of a loop, but I've always like a really tricky relationship to the word research in architecture. Just because, I mean, not that it's not possible, but I think because it's ultimately so different from research in all sorts of other disciplines, let's say engineering, environment, or any sorts of science, just because, I mean, this is such an overlap of things that you couldn't, of variables in a way that you put together. Kind of what you're trying to reach with it, also with the performance criteria. I mean, performance normally is something they can easily test. right? I mean, then you can say yes or no, it did perform well. So, like, how would you do it? I mean, so ask you back, how would you test it?
I think that's a big question. I think you framed it very well, that architecture performance is not the same as engineering performance, and that's what we're spending our time doing, is trying to define how architecture performs, and it performs as the level of function as well as image and beauty and performance in terms of, you know, technology. I mean, it functions as and cultural performance. You know, I mean, it touches upon all these things. And I think for us, some architects give priority to certain aspects and other. I think that's the question. I don't have an answer, I think. And maybe that's better.
Right.
Because if not, we would know immediately what's good and what's bad.
It, right.
It would be like, you know, over. Yeah. Bye.
But we still want to discuss the projects in a performative way. Right? It's kind of what we were talking about before. Mm-hmm. But it's like, you know, no one's asking Peter Zumthor how the water goes in and out of his baths, right? Or, I mean, you don't read about that a lot.
But maybe
because his definition of performance is beauty, light, views, you know, this kind of...
Right, but I think that you could take a Peter Zumthor project and look at it from the point of view of plumbing. Maybe it's also that we don't want to ask the tough questions and take architecture with the big A still apart. And, I mean, I think you can look at it in terms of social impact or cultural impact or... plumbing impact or efficiency or, you know, I mean, I think that maybe there's not, I actually think there's not enough, it's always the same, the amount of criticism we're applying to architecture is still very narrow compared to all, to kind of the number of ways in which we can examine it. Mm-hmm. And I think just coming back to how we talk about it, I think it's, I mean, for us it's because we're not satisfied with the ways, we're not convinced that the ways we're supposed to talk about it are the most interesting today. But,
right. But I think it's like you say, you know, if you really wanted it to perform, you would just cover it with insulation, in a way, right? I mean, or that's what they're saying in Germany, right?
Yeah.
That just...
And that's actually one of the big dangers of, like, practicing in Germany, because I don't think the clarity of what you want to achieve with, like, if you talk about performance or environmental or architecture, like in a specific framework now, environmental performance, in the sense it's generally perceived, it's quite odd. And, like, actually, that was the starting point for the House in Heat, because I was, like, just coming in there again on a train station. So this huge poster of that building having that second layer on it. Now it's even, you know, it had a second layer of, there's this one, it's rock bottom price material. It's basically a composite of, like, foam, insulation, and then you plaster it. Can't go any cheaper, you can't get any higher degree of insulation. But then, and so the poster was actually put out there with, like, a false color image over it, right? So you could actually literally see how that new skin performed on that same one. So actually it became the starting point for a project somewhere else in Chile, where that discussion wasn't really taking place in the same way. Especially now only with our client, who was French, and whom I tried to, like, cook all the time in terms of giving us, like, something to describe. I mean, you know how it is, like, describe a little bit, describe what you were after. So the only thing he was talking about was solar panels and so on. It's a really odd discussion. And so, like I said, if you want that, let's really start at that end, like, to almost odd. So we put his kind of lack of specificity for a moment, let's say, and on the other hand, like, kind of the oddness of how you actually define, like, the performative idea or environmental idea of environmental performance, put them together and let them play out in a way. And so, like, this whole thing emerged out of these two kind of oddities in a way.
But then I assume as a result there are also new social conditions that you create.
Exactly.
Created, right?
So, like, that's then, so suddenly, like, the project actually, the way the first models then became kind of the one way to actually discuss these things that you really want to get at, in a way. So, suddenly, I mean, the way it's organized suddenly with the this when you obviously have these heat sources or heat pockets on the side, so this one open space with the floor topography, let's say, which then has all sorts of different local kind of heatings and cooling zones. And so suddenly, I mean, something interesting comes about that is suddenly you don't start to temperate like a whole space anymore. It's not homogeneous anymore, but suddenly it becomes local and it becomes very specific to a specific point in time. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the whole thing becomes kind of almost a game of where, like, we could start to play, like, what are the activities, what mm-hmm. are these kind of patterns of how do you actually, and then how do you want to live? And then suddenly you have something at your hand to ask him. So, like, you know, what are these patterns? Like, what are these things? Like, how do you relate them to specific times of the day, mm-hmm. to specific times of the year, to the orientation of the house? And so suddenly you have something where actually the material performance or the environmental performance of something is A, driving some mm-hmm. of the mm-hmm. structuring of it, but B, also means it works as a tool to communicate in the first place with the client in a way.
Right.
And so I thought that was kind of interesting that you could, it has like a double mm-hmm. double performance.
Right. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But it's also, I mean, that's the beauty, I think, of this, of that way of presenting a project, is that the failure to be completely scientific is what produces interest.
Yeah. Right. No, exactly.
So it's also not a fait accompli.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not. So, you know, I mean, I think that at the moment we're setting up these narratives, we're also setting ourselves up to create interesting moments when mm-hmm. we fail.
Right. Right. Yeah.
I mean,
right.
That's.
No,
you know,
no.
I think that's what doesn't come across in a, let's say, a criticism, like I guess Michael was. Of that approach.
Right. But the other thing is to look at it more from the point of view of reception. There was a really interesting article in the New York Times magazine, and I mean, it's based on kind of economic, you know, how people make decisions, right? Mm-hmm. And short-term decision, you know, relative to risk versus long-term decision relative to risk. And it was very, there were two things that were very clear. And that goes back to this notion of awareness or creating an environment that triggers awareness. Mm-hmm. They did the study that in Alaska, even though the icebergs are melting, people who don't see the iceberg melting don't feel the pressure to do something. And the people who are intimately watching them melt know that there's a kind of emergency. That was the first kind of result of this study, and the second is that if we make decisions as a group, as a collective, our decisions are very different than if we make them as individuals. Mm-hmm. So you deciding to paint your house in a green paint, you know, you might decide at the last minute to go with the cheaper paint that's not green, right? Versus if we were having a meeting and everybody was kind of discussing on how to, you know, make a better world, let's say, we might make better decisions that are not so individually. And so, I mean, I think there's also something there with architecture of what we do, which is just kind of trigger questions. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, where if you're in a room that changes temperature or, you know, just a sense of experience which kind of heightens your knowledge of mm-hmm. how you're connected to the world. I mean, I think that's another role that's quite interesting. And then it would perform at that level, and it's mm-hmm. not the same idea of performance, but it's as important if you think that may influence truly mm-hmm. how somebody thinks, right? I mean, there was kind of, and I think the houses that you've done do that, right? I mean, by reshuffling completely the way people are supposed to use them, or, you know, even questions of beauty or just kind of hierarchy in the house. And I mean, you know, for me this is also really kind of intriguing. So architecture is a big question mark. Anyway, that was go ahead.
It only partially goes in there, but anyway, the curious moment I recently came across, I didn't really know about it, but there's this Russian lifestyle magazine. And they had like a an oil painting done of the house, of the wall house.
Oh yeah.
And with the Land Rover in front, created a whole new lifestyle around it, or in a kind of a desirability in the middle of,
right,
of Russia in a way. And I was kind of, and the way there was all sorts of funny things about it, because I literally repainted a photo. You see the same person, the same kind of things, constellations of things. But it is odd to see like how actually there could be something created around the house or a project like that, which goes far beyond its like own means of, you know, how is it constructed, how is it made, how is it delivered, la la la, how does it perform, but like, you know, create this whole idea of how you live around it, mm-hmm, like to in a scale that is far bigger. It's not even the context of Santiago or mm-hmm Chile anymore. It's like suddenly in a whole other world, a whole other climate, which, you know, it was
right,
obviously
right,
not even ever thought of. And so, I don't know, it doesn't really go to your question.
No, but
so
it does, because then, the kind of narrative you constructed around the performance in a certain environment is now completely sort of replaced by another one in Russia.
Yeah. My personal, I found it funny at the same time, like, there was something I found, the similarity to the graphics of it, they were just, like, too close to the
right
images of, like, Putin, like, doing the, you know, when he was, like, all doing the natural thing,
I don't know if the media here, too.
Like, the back to the roots hunting,
right,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I felt like, I wasn't quite sure, I was wondering if I should put it on our blog, actually,
right,
together with that, and just, like, wonder if you should like it or not.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
anyways, didn't at the end.
But yeah, it's the dasha,
funny,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
The little hut. I mean, I think that the wall house must have some kind of incredible resonance. I mean, because it was, I mean, I assume it was like a phenomena in a way for the
yeah, for us, it's, yeah,
number of times it got published. I mean, we've seen it so many places.
It's been like that for
right,
that project. Has been,
but
really
it's just amazing that something so experimental and so unhouse-like, let's say, for the normal day-to-day person resonates across, you know, such a broad spectrum.
Uh-huh.
And I wonder, I don't know, I mean, maybe it is something with the tent-like quality or the kind of back to nature or, you know, something that makes it that important to people, I guess. I don't know.
So the ones that are not really up for camping, but want to give it a try. No, but there's a couple of other issues that we're trying to also like push out of it, which is now it's like something that came up earlier too. Like, how do you suddenly get away? I mean, this was obviously a client, classic relationship, client architect service project, and so a while ago we set up this. This online store, yourwallhouse.net, where you could actually purchase in different kind of constellation. I mean, you could either go with exactly the one, or you could
right,
actually, we could work together with you or them to go and develop it on a different within a different environmental realm, because suddenly it's not localized at all anymore. So it's to trigger all sorts of interesting questions, and because what the material logics in a way allow is that you could like go layer by layer and choose or
right,
adjust and tune it up.
True. It's better than a compressed wall section.
It's the opposite of the composite in a way.
And it was brief. A lot of it was prefabricated.
A lot of it was prefab.
Yeah,
and and the way it was actually constructed was also a lot of almost do it yourself, because the reality, at least in our building. That was the first thing built, also. But with the reality of building it's actually the suburbs of Santiago.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it always looks it's in the nowhere, it's
right,
actually kind of hybrid. It's called the rural suburbs. There's lots of a minimum of 5,000 square meters, so 50,000 square feet.
Yeah.
And and you're not allowed to subdivide. It's and so there's a whole lot of people around there. I mean, it's all around. It's actually an old asparagus field, which is still. Productive, exactly.
Yeah.
But back to the logic of making it the do-it-yourself kind of a reality of some of it, because there was a workforce of like up to 25 people a day, but what they would normally do, they would wash your car, they would mow your lawn or whatever, and like today, well, they build your house. And so suddenly you're kind of confronted with this reality in a way. And so for example, that polycarbonate is like a tongue and groove, which is, I mean, normally it isn't. There's all sorts of other profiles. So this is it's not something specifically made. The only thing specifically made is that the substructure that we chose for it is the C-channels that go into a sheetrock wall.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody knows that. I mean, so there's nothing easier to deal with that. And so the only point became, how do you connect that as a substructure? So the only thing we had changed was actually the connection to that. Or the tent structure was then fabricated by these people who normally do these blow-up or pump-up jumping castles for kids. this local workshop, which you can't even believe. I mean, that they would make
like some... for the world or for Chile. I mean, is that the jumping castle?
No, for Chile. No, I don't know. It's like I don't think they have the capacities
for it.
It's not what the shop looked like. I mean, because the whole tent was completely going over the street, over the backyard, because it's far too big for their little shop. But I mean, for me, one of the interesting parts about it is like this whole the whole economy. I mean, in the wider sense of the word. Of making these play, you know, to be played with, to work with. And so, there is the prefabrication and so on, which is might be interesting, might not be interesting to other in certain contexts. But suddenly you deal with, and that's partially also what I find, what I consider to some degree an important part of the setup of our office, is that you're confronted with a very different economical or production setup in these places, or legal framework within this, a cultural framework, most obviously, which the Home Sweet Camouflage was going for, and so I find that really intriguing. And so part of that is that one is in the place, but not all the time. You know, that there's a little bit of a position to always escape it and to like look at it again with fresh eyes from.
When you go back to LA.
Yeah.
I mean,
we're right on track here.
that takes us to the second question.
Section number two.
But they're all sort of connected. But I think, I'm just going to introduce it.
Come on, go ahead.
Look, for example, I'm invited to speak at the AIA, and the kind of question is framed like this. What are the issues, challenges, and difficulties of working in the global world or of a global practice? And
so three negative qualifiers.
and then the question is, you know, relative to what? First of all, like what image of the architect? Mm-hmm. You know, and the second is that I feel like we, and especially, I mean, you, given how you're working, it's almost a quote-unquote natural condition. You know, we are born as architects in this condition, and we look at it more as a positive. I mean, we're sort of this idea of networking, and of you're based in LA, but you work everywhere else but LA. It seems your partner is Chilean, and you know, I mean, it's this.
Well, but it's not everywhere. I mean, I think that's what makes it really interesting. Is it's like a kind of perfect global. That's what the architect would call it, I think. You know, because you're, I mean, it's super global, but then also you're in your hometown, kind of, in a way. So,
through networks and friends and collaborators and people that you've worked with in the past, or like there's this kind of amazing network where you're immediately plugged in at the level of the local, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you're not this sort of flown-in architect who's romanticizing.
No, I know, but that's an interesting challenge even right now. If you consider, like... If you consider what, you know, the kind of, call it the rumors of, you know, that this economic crisis basically also kind of flushing away, you know, some of the, that part of the...
Right,
of the architectural circles.
Yeah.
I mean, it becomes also interesting if there's an alternative model of actually being able to work or deliver something that has a certain specificity to a local condition, and but at the same time not being that. I mean, in a strange way, I mean, if you look at all of, large parts of South America, like, I mean, there have been, like, whenever architecture came in from the outside, it was kind of, I don't want to use the word hostile takeover, but I mean, it was...
It was colonizing, right?
Yeah, well, pretty much. I mean, even the modern thing. So, so the question now becomes, that's something, again, like one of these questions not answerable right now, but I mean, what at least to my interest is to actually find a different way that these things actually come together. And like ultimately, I'm also interested, really interested in the things that we can bring from Chile to Germany or from,
right.
You know, and
yeah, that's like, because you're always local and always fluent, yeah. If you're both working together. Right?
Yeah.
So you're always a Chilean reading Germany and Germany.
Yeah, exactly. And that becomes really interesting because like mostly the way it's discussed, I mean, it's always the one way. I mean, the way it's set up right now. And I mean, what I'm hoping for at least that soon enough we'll get in a condition where actually there is something coming back in a way. And
yeah. But it seems in the way that you were describing the polycarbonate and how it's, uh-huh. You know, I mean, by plugging into a set of collaborators that, you know, wherever you land, there is an exchange, right? It's not mm-hmm. a one-way, and I think that, I mean, it seems very natural, right? I mean, that's how you...
Yeah, I hope that's, I mean, that's the idea also, the way the office is set up. I mean, mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
why did you choose LA? Yeah. I mean, why this triangle of...
It's not a triangle.
Is it like you're neither in your
yeah.
home and neither in...
Your yeah. Are there also answers off record?
Yeah.
No, but there was like at the point there was like a really... I mean, there was all sorts of different exactly. things that came together. But, I mean, I went to school, last part of when I went to school, which was after we met, it's like I was in Houston, graduated from
right.
ICE, went back to, I had to leave because of that, you know, home rule, whatever it's called. So I left for 3 years and I started the office and also started teaching in Germany. And it was like two things I was interested to get back into a different discourse in terms of the teaching or the academic side of things. Which was also like the idea of going back to the U.S. A, mm. And the other side was also real problems was like from Germany to Santiago, from Frankfurt to Santiago. It's a 19-hour flight. It's completely mm. undoable. And so I mean, there is actually a natural triangle, which was
right.
either
right.
A Houston, but that's my hometown again. I mean,
yeah.
Right. Live for 5 years,
yeah.
Or it would be LA in a way, yeah. and so it's looking actually what are the places
right.
which have actually an interesting mm-hmm. Academic surrounding and which kind of complete the loop, and also at the time we were working on Antebrush in Mexico City, which was then
right.
really
really close, yeah, yeah.
So it says something about the current condition, where as a young architect you can decide. You know where you know you can actually decide where to set your architectural
but, I mean,
roots.
Think, yeah,
you know.
But I mean they are really specific to kind of oddities of your
right.
personal
yeah.
past
yeah.
in a way.
Yeah.
Or your
was that,
I mean,
that was the off the record answer. That was not as juicy as that.
No. I mean, if you would ever talk about like, I mean, which was not quite the case, but if you would ever say like, the only reason I'm teaching at your school is because it was just half
oh, right.
like,
yeah.
it's not the
I
way
think,
you want to go.
I think that falls precisely within the way you describe your work. I think that you know,
it's
there's
things
in
you
the,
find, right?
Yeah.
And you decided that distance was the uh-huh. factor, and you landed in LA. I think it's a perfect answer. That's really
the reason we give for why we teach is that somebody asked us to teach, so I think it's almost worse.
And are you teaching now? You are teaching
yeah right now the semester is over, just like now,
but you're at Saya.
My answer to that question is to support my architecture habit,
right?
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I know.
It is an expensive habit, the profession of architecture.
That question, I mean, not so much, but the kind of global, local, and takes me to another question, which is...
But there's one other interesting
yeah.
point, which is even within the office, which partly is for just pragmatic reasons, for example, during the semester that I am bound to LA, but so like, how do we keep things going? And so there is actually like when during the last couple of months, like all these people working in LA were from Germany. Like how from the people in Chile, there's no person from Chile. There's one from Colombia. There's one from from the U.S. and one from Germany. And then now it's Germany. Is someone coming from living in LA, but actually from Singapore? I think there's something nice also like with people, like all these people actually not in their natural
right.
habitat or surrounding, but like suddenly if for a certain amount of time or for a longer period of time, if they also like kind of go out of the usual routines, out of the usual kind of environment, I think it's pretty stimulating to have that as a setup. So to some degree, they are also pragmatic decisions. But at the same time, I think there's something to be found in that which is actually quite productive, because everybody
reads situations in a different way.
But LA is a really different place than New York, and I mean, you could have chosen New York equally, I would say, at that almost halfway point, right? And coming from Houston and from Rice, I think that school has. You could go. I mean, that school is a real sort of hybrid between the East and West Coast.
Yeah, it is.
So.
Why West, not East?
Yeah. I mean, maybe it was just chance, but it seems go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
It does seem more affiliated with a kind of West Coast.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
Sensibility.
I was going to say,
I think there's
the
residential, I think.
Well, the logic of the residential would be that LA would be the natural choice. Yeah. Because, the architectural invention glory certainly doesn't lie in one single public
project.
It's one
that very different.
Yeah. Almost unpublishable.
Yeah.
I think there is that history trajectory.
That's true, with the houses and the experimentation with living.
Perfect point.
And are you both in LA sometimes, or?
No, Mario's most of the time actually in Santiago.
Okay.
And I go to Santiago probably like 3 times a year.
Yeah.
So he's in Germany every once in a while.
Right.
So.
And you're en route to Germany now?
Yeah.
I feel it. New York is a good stopping.
Yeah, we stopped here because it was a good stopping point.
We wanted to go to LA.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, we tried.
We tried.
Yes.
But anyway, it's not about us. That takes me to another, pushing this idea. You were talking that within your office, people come from different backgrounds, and that creates a richness. Wow, thank you. But also we were talking about this network within which you plug in when you land somewhere, and just kind of avoids the sort of complete outsider projecting or romanticizing a condition. I mean, there's another kind of emerging role maybe of the architect, which has emerged already and is in music or in art, which is the architect as producer. And I think that is most visible maybe in your book, in the way that you sort of collaborate, right, with thinkers, scientists, artists, etc., right, where you sort of set up a situation and then everybody brings in their expertise and you're kind of directing the...
Mm-hmm.
So it's no longer this kind of single, all-powerful voice that, the architect against the world, but it's more like the architect within the world sort of producing...
Is that the word?
I wonder.
My thesis project, but
I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit. I do feel like whenever you talk to someone from our generation, the collaboration comes up as something that is extremely
important.
Exciting. That you're not again this kind of voice against, but voice within, and that it's really important to be. It's even more exciting to be part of these kind of multiple expertise. And
I think it's almost a natural kind of decision to. I mean. It's again like our starting point, like everything is a natural decision. Obviously, it could have gone completely different, but I think it's almost, it is though in the sense that in terms of like the work also being stimulating, the process of working being stimulating to oneself, I think that's actually, it's from my perspective, a really interesting route to go, to see that there is, you can, all these different, within the different projects, some of them within the office, and some of them are actually also not quite really office projects. They suddenly get in the boundary and think, you know, they're not even that anymore. But I think that suddenly allows you to provide a variety of formats, of scales of things, because otherwise you're easily locked into like really growing your, I mean, I have, strangely enough, I mean, when you ever you see, or not whenever, but like quite a couple of people from also from our generation, you know, go to their websites and suddenly, you know, well, the first sentences is there were a team of 50, 60, 70. And it seems to be like a qualifying factor. And it's like, I always found that a little odd to me. In a way, the thing that intrigues me about an alternative setup is actually that you suddenly you just have like a really small group of people around with you.
Yeah.
And then wherever you go, in terms of locality, but also in terms of scale of a project or kind of framework that you work with. And for example, on the Magnusstrasse project, there was a lawyer as part of the design team. It's like, well, I mean, you don't normally get that. Normally you just like go and get some feedback afterwards, or you're involved in some nasty suit yourself. But it's really intriguing suddenly to work, get their perspective or get their input, because suddenly they have a certain degree of precision in that sense.
Right.
Again, not engineering precision, but precision in this that they bring to the table, which is quite intriguing. And so what seems probably like an odd choice in the first place suddenly becomes something that is extremely exciting and informative in the process. So I like that part. And like, I don't think there's any way and no interest whatsoever to suddenly wanting to integrate all that into like a into an office format.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm always amazed. Like, I just read the Corbu biography, and you know, I mean, it was like 10 people maximum, you know, doing all these projects all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And Breuer was, I think, never more than 12 or 15 people with like 30 ongoing projects. It's like, I don't know how we forgot how to like have a dedicated team, you know? Might be the OMA effect. Nobody's staying longer than a year. I don't know. But what I was going to switch to. I mean, do you think? I mean, in general, because I think that a lot of times it does go that way. You know, I mean, or it's interesting where a lawyer comes onto your team and has input in. And I think that what was interesting, at least as a possibility in the book that you were involved with, was the architect kind of going the other way. And I don't know if that really happened. So, I mean, I wasn't sure exactly what your input in that book was, whether it was only kind of architectural sketches or whether
which,
the architect...
Which book exactly?
It was the book about knowledge and as a commodity.
Oh, there's two things. I mean, there's like the one research... Are you referring to the source book, Science Communication? Is that the one?
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
Basically, instead of us bringing in lawyers, scientists, farmers, engineers,
it
was actually quite interesting because there was, I mean, it's a
kind of... Could we become important, relevant to others?
Yeah, and which is quite interesting because, I mean, that's like one of the... It's like one of these things that in the last couple of years, partly within the office and partly outside and through teaching, involved with was... actually learning environments. And that was, and so however it started up, but there was the publication you're referring to was, it was a youth funded research study, and because there's some fear going on in some of the universities in Germany, because I mean we're back at the engineering, which is such an important, our science and engineering, such an important part of the self-definition or economic factor or whatever you take, and so that actually there is no interest altogether in that subject matter anymore, and so there was a specific region, partly within Germany, partly within the Netherlands, and partly within Belgium. They're kind of these subplots of the EU in a way, these border regions. So they said, like, okay, we need to go about it, but like obviously they basically just framed, okay, this is our fear, and it's like, but we don't know. And so suddenly it became interesting that what are actually these institutions that we could latch on to, what actually means, and that's where architecture or the knowledge what we do potentially is also interesting, is the question. So these things are quite abstract as problems, scientific or engineering problems at this point. I mean, in scale, they're either so small you don't even see them anymore, or so large you can barely grasp them. So, like, I mean, how do you actually make, how do you manage to make them perceptible, understandable, or do you communicate them? What are the institutions you could latch on to? And also, the, what is out there in terms of framework? So we started to actually look and talk to people at the ZKM, which is, I don't know if you're at all, I mean, there was the right, HOMA competition years ago, but like it's quite an interesting framework because they bring some of these aspects in there. And so, yeah, there is moments, I mean, I don't think they happen all that often yet, but I mean, I would hope for them to actually become a larger part of it in a sense, but so that you actually venture off into, or you're asked to actually venture off and contribute to something which is a little bit a sideline to it.
Tangential, and maybe where we bring a certain skill in representing, right? I guess that was what Ian Moore tried to do a little bit, right? Kind of consulting outside of architecture. I'm not sure it was that successful in the end.
No, but it was, I mean,
it was interesting.
The Condé Nast projects were like that, where there was no architectural anything, you know, just look at a magazine and see how it could be better, you know. But then, recently I don't think it's like that. No, I think it's a totally different subject. I think an interesting one, given your work, the question of representation. Because I think, I mean, it's very distinct, your way of representing the projects. You know, I think from the physical models, which I think resonate with a lot of other young practices, but then combined with kind of pencil sketches and you know, the photo collages and this kind of presentation where it seems like the borders of the page are shown, you know, as almost like an art, like a more artistic, like a Alice Aycock collage or something. And so, and I think it's interesting, how do you square that? Because we have a real affinity for that, you know, that kind of level of craft and touch of the physical. How do you square it with, you know, everything else that's going on, and, you know, Second Life, and, you know, the kind of preponderance of computers. And is it a stance? I mean, is it was it a conscious thing to represent the projects in that way? Or
are you annoyed with the digital?
It's something that's floating out there right now. It seems, because someone recently told me that now at Bartlett everybody's just doing hand drawings. There's no digital drawings at all. No, but which I find interesting. But I'm not particularly annoyed, but at the same time, I think I just want to escape the danger of kind of a. That it actually becomes limiting more than anything in a way, that there is like a suddenly homogeneity in this or brought through this, and so even in that realm of specific aspects of or implied aesthetics, like I found Second Life quite interesting in that, because it's so crude in a way, and it leaves it's so against any kind of graphic sensibility in the first place that we bring with us as architects, but like suddenly it's like something that is quite interesting to tap into for a moment and see what it has to offer actually in the way, because it works quite well in communicating in certain ways, in the way people can interact with it. I'm not sure, other than that, no, I don't know, it's with the digital.
No, I just think it's interesting that you can at the same time, like with the collage project, present, the camouflage project, you present a kind of classic parametric design aspect to it, right, where you've written a program and a simple grid generates kind of complex forms, you know, and then you can present the same project with hand drawings. I mean, is it, to me it seems a little bit like a stance, you know, like, you know, you shouldn't, you know, in a way it's like architecture is more full. You know,
no, no. I mean, shouldn't we at this point like be beyond a certain ideology of of means.
Yeah.
Right. So I think we suddenly have, we're at this great time where we have all these means at our hands.
It's a collection of tools.
It's a collection of tools. Yeah, and like, I think the interesting part about this is now that we actually can make use of the full variety of those, which, you know, in the mid-90s, that was not the thing, because like the obviously the one was emerging at the time. Yeah. And so there was also a baggage associated with it, and I feel like, lucky enough, we don't have that baggage right now to carry anymore. Yeah, I think,
I think that's really interesting. I mean, we feel the same way, that it's not... Look, writers don't go on and on about their computer, you know? I mean, you know, I think there was an exploration that was made, and it was made, and it was great, but I think...
I don't love parametric writing either.
Set up a thing, and... Doesn't really make a lot of sense, but...
But, you know, and
actually, there is somebody who's writing.
I'm sure there is.
I'm sure there is.
Goodness has found this person. And I keep forgetting to. So now it's on tape, so I'll actually get myself around to doing it. I keep forgetting to ask him to mention the person's name.
Right.
And I've never gone to
read it. Because there is someone doesn't mean it's going to end up on the New York Times list.
But I still want to see what this thing is.
Yeah.
So.
But I think you said it very clearly, the virtual is cruder than the real, I mean, in some ways, in many ways. Also, you know, I mean, I think that it's kind of Bruno Latour's kind of...
Well, I mean, that's a large part. I mean, much of what we've been doing is also like that... probably, like, it would be kind of to describe it as scavenger. I mean, it's not that we invent all sorts of things. I mean, you know, the wall is quite low tech in that sense, right? You just take, you know, a material that's been out there forever. But even in the means of taking on specific other things, I'm still interested in, like, I mean, for example, taking some of these parametric aspects. I'm not always sure about if we're applying it at the right scale of things. I mean, from my personal perspective, I think... But at the same time, the great thing about it is that these things are out there right now, and we can actually just now play with them, but not without a certain ideological baggage. And I think that's actually quite important to me. Which
beyond ideology, are we there finally?
What is the end of the Camouflage House story? Is there an end?
It's
ended soon after.
No, there is an end to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's almost as camouflaged as it gets. You can barely see that we designed anything on it.
Right. And the pattern's not there, or?
Oh, the pattern's not there in that sense, no.
So it's the ultimate camouflage.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. It's like camouflage.
Somebody was saying something yesterday about camouflage being the most visible thing, actually. I forget. Anyway.
I don't know. There are those boats that they painted, like, these crazy patterns. They were so loud that... people couldn't see them.
Bedazzle ships.
Yeah.
That's actually it was the one of the original forms of camouflage, which was developed rather than there's these.
Have
kind
you
of,
seen them? They're crazy.
No, what?
They're like crazy patterns.
Yeah, there's these sort of crazy angular patterns, and the idea was that you couldn't tell where the front of the back or the sides were.
Right. So it wasn't that you can't see the boat, dazzle? It's like you don't know exactly.
Yeah, the dazzle ships. They were from the World War I. I did a studio on camouflage.
So. Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, and you know, even thinking about camouflage in terms of performance, like the stealth bomber, actually it's not meant to, it's not that the shape is camouflage, I mean the look of it's camouflage, but it's camouflaged from the radar.
Yeah.
And it all has to do with the curvature and the way that the things bounce off it deflects. It has sort of maximum deflection of the rays so that you can't see it on radar.
Hmm.
Anyway.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So where do you go from where you are? what's in the works? What are you satisfied with and what are you not? Or I don't know.
What am I satisfied? We just recently It's always interesting, like along the way you start to open all sorts of tabs in a way, and I mean it's like going to a bar, right? You open a tab and then, you know, later hopefully at some point you close it. But so when I was talking about all these working on in different means on educational projects and worlds and rooms, so we've kind of made our step into which might also have to do with the economy, but we made our step into public projects now, in, or at least the kind of early steps of it. But like trying to work a little bit in a different scale of things, with different agendas associated with it, even though I still really like the, as I said earlier, residential scale to things. So that's one of the things. So we're working on a just recently finished an invited competition with like six other firms for the first university campus that's going to be built in Germany from scratch till 2012. It was a huge undertaking in a way, and so, you know, suddenly a strange different scale of things. But I mean, the interesting part is that many of the things that suddenly appear again that appear still kind of have similar trajectories, at least in a way. I was talking earlier about economic or like legal frameworks of things. So suddenly, we're left in the private. I mean, there was a set of really interesting questions associated with it, and you cut it out if it just goes too far. But they weren't asking anymore. They were asking two questions. The one question was, okay, how much is it allowed to cost, or how much does your proposal cost? You know, that's a 5-page document, and then a 200-page document. How much is the building going to cost the whole campus going to cost over the next 30 years? Really interesting shift, which suddenly puts a real interesting other perspective on things. I think as in terms of how you think about your project suddenly having a time factor. But so suddenly, then like even if it was like. As I said, like a whole different scale of things, operations. But so again, we landed at the facade for some part of it, because actually the building is owned publicly in our proposal, but all the south facades are actually owned by a private contractor who harvests energy and sells energy. So suddenly you split the building up, not so literally as you do in the wall house, I mean, where you literally separate them. But the whole way of like being able to like deliver a scheme that was in the cost range for right now, we could only stay with saying, okay, you actually have this, but you don't even have to pay for the facade because that is like someone else's, and they at the same time then become part of the larger environmental scheme for this as they sell it back to the to them, and which is outside architecture, and it's already a common practice in a sense that these things happen. So again, it made its way back to at least some aspects of it to the word of the ongoing, but not literally in that sense. Yeah. So that's something I felt kind of excited that suddenly you're working in a whole different realm, in a whole different scale, but some ideas kind of keep going.
I think that. I mean, when we started our office, that was our intuition. I mean, we still can't necessarily articulate, you know, a project for the office. I'm not even sure it's necessary to articulate it. But you know, what you're saying is, like, as you move through, you're opening tabs. And I think as you also move globally, and as you're constantly looking at things in relation to other things and evaluating them, and something kind of emerges that is not necessarily a preconceived formulation of what your work is about. And I think that, you know, you can start sort of, as you know, reading trajectories or having a number of kind of parallel projects, but they're not you know, it's very interesting. It's sort of like you come back,
right? Well, it's kind of like in the two-in-one house, how you have a kind of house project but also a reading of the city and the potential for the development.
Actually, there is also an open tap in a way, as it develops a whole set of different things out of it, which we're right now in the next couple of weeks getting into, like even like, you know, then offspring of that, because there's suddenly, I mean, that's the exciting part. It's so hard for me to actually say like where are you going next, because I think Right. One of the part, sorry, one of these aspects about working that way is actually that, well, so that within a specific project, suddenly some other thing might or comes up as an offspring, as like a further trajectory out of it. So it's hard to say that there's like, hard for me to really lay out kind of, you know, a 5-year, is it 5-year plans that normally are made? Yeah. You know, they don't really exist in that sense.
I just want to say we've been going like an hour and 10, which is fine. But I probably am going to have to go feed in about 15. So
yeah. I think we're done.
Oh,
we were just continuing on opening up.
Keep going, other tabs.
I thought there were more tabs. Yeah.
We have actually hit all of ours. Well, there was an ecology question, but I think we talked about that.
Yeah.
What about the? One thing, you know, we were trying to hope that there would be some consistency in the question. We did send you the questions, didn't we?
No.
No, this happened to you guys too. Do you have?
Oh, sorry. Okay. Yeah, what are the questions that we need to ask?
There was a list of 10 questions.
Oh, really?
Or 11 questions that we sent.
Well,
I swear, that's why
you were saying you can't go about it.
Yeah. That was like why I was here too. Oh.
Did we hit some of them?
You hit most of them, actually. I thought you were reformulating
some
of our questions. You wrote your own.
We wrote our own.
I sent an email like 3 days ago to everybody, I thought, confirming the time and saying no.
Well, it's okay. I mean, we'll go through and see what we didn't cover.
Yeah.
We didn't have to watch the whole lecture.
It's so much easier. Here we go.
Pick one or two off of there and.
Okay. Work in relation to the other firms. That's a good one.
Praxis 200.
Yeah, so the first question is good, right?
Yeah.
Who do you consider your peers? Quote unquote generation. That exists.
Could I find that one of the trickiest ones? Because I mean, someone could draw kind of obvious either formal family relationships or in terms of interests.
Okay.
But at the same time, I think. Let me reread. Is it only the peers, or is it also like kind of the influences?
I think you should combine.
Yeah, because I mean, in terms of the influences, I feel almost looking at completely different sets, also in terms of time frames or context. So I always find it hard. I mean, as it's a natural desire, I think, also to kind of not. I mean, to some degree, obviously, one profits from being stamped in a way, right? I mean, it's always been kind of this something school. But at the same time, I think there's something also liberating to at least momentarily escape it. So I would find it hard to answer the question, actually. Mm-hmm.
Do you know most of the firms in the issue?
Where?
Do you know most of the firms who are in most of the 10 firms?
I looked into them. It's like some of them I know. I mean, obviously, right. I mean, I know the ones from Latin America and from Mexico and from Chile. Mm-hmm. But and some of the others that I didn't know some now. But yeah.
And do you feel? I mean, in New York, we definitely have a group, you know, that I think we feel very close with. Even though our work maybe is different, I do feel like we share. Well, I mean, we share struggles, and we, you know, I mean, is it? Do you have that in LA as well, or? In Cologne, or I mean, are you so much in other places that you're not able to kind of?
No, actually, but I think they're stronger actually in Cologne or in Germany in general. I mean, probably Cologne, Berlin, but there's definitely a group of people there that, even though like it's more, I mean, they might even kind of represent kind of completely different trajectories, but yeah, probably it's kind of the. Kind of larger pool. So it's more strongly there and actually in Chile.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
That's him.
Yeah. Oh, yeah?
Oh, he's lost it. Yeah, Mark just called. He's on his way.
Can you name a recent or another project that kind of has had great impact on you? Or
is that in here?
Yeah.
A project?
I see.
Third floor.
A recent project.
It doesn't even have to
be
recent.
You can probably leave this room after the second door if you want.
I'm trying to think. That's like this on the spot. It's always, I mean, there surely are. Next, I take the
Our questions were easy to answer.
Easy one. What resources, books, magazines, blogs, websites, publications do you refer to most often and why?
It's a good one. Even though I was hoping that wouldn't come up, but in terms of publications, currently the publications are, I mean, there's Art Plus, a German publication, which probably knows from the Oma side. Oma has been kind of a in and out there. But I think what even though probably most people here that read Praxis don't know it in the American context, but I think what's interesting about it is actually there's one of these few publications.
Oh.
Sorry. This is when all of this becomes completely irrelevant.
What I find interesting about that one is actually it's one of the few publications left, I feel, that hasn't completely gone one extreme or the other in terms of being completely or exclusively focused in a theoretical discourse side or complete, you know, these are the buildings or how you build, where you build, and so on. So I think it's like an interesting...
I'm break things up.
No problem.
You quiet it down for some reason. Very good.
So that's kind of probably one of these resources. Other than that, I always find that whenever you get into a project, there are kind of excuses to suddenly trigger specific, you know, build up specific reading lists, or looking into certain things because you're confronted with either a new perspective on a topic or a completely new topic. So that's, I think, more...
So again, it's kind of through the project that you can uncover.
Yeah, and then suddenly feel. I mean, if the project has to offer something, suddenly then you start to actually continue that trajectory. So I mean, you know, you look into.
I mean, we're not only read detail when we hit CDs, basically. It's a high level.
Why else would you? This is another question which will reformulate it in the sense that I believe that these issues are very specific to certain schools in the US, and so I'm curious about what it means to the outside. So the question is, which, if any, aspect of contemporary discourses, post-criticality, effect, pragmatism, ecology, sustainability, beauty, etc., do you feel most closely affiliated with or antagonistic to? And so I will add, and is that at all relevant in, you know, Germany, Chile, Mexico? And I also, you know, don't know why one excludes the other. But
Right. Mm.
Well, I mean, obviously, one which is a really interesting problem is the one of the possibility of maintaining a critical position. But I mean, like wondering, and you might have to talk back about that in like probably 5 or 10 years. But the question is: there actually an alternative to the one of the just outside, you know, critical position that was, I mean, that has been quite strong, especially I think in the context of the U.S. from my perspective at least, and the one which is loses any sort of critical, which is just the making architect in a way, practicing architect. So like, I mean, I would hope for there to be another, a third route within this where you can actually maintain a certain degree of criticality. And like, but I mean, it's, I don't know, we might easily be in the world of wishful thinking, so that's what I'm saying. We might, you know, it might be something we should schedule something for today in 5 years and see where we both stand. And
yeah.
With that. But how do you see
we,
that?
I mean, I think we are...
Well,
we don't totally agree on it, right? Mm-hmm. I think that...
Well, okay.
Because... Huh? No, I mean, we really don't agree on it.
Do you think okay. those discourses are from yeah. another generation, too?
Well, I do. I think the either or is from a another generation. I think that the framing of the critical and the post-critical is refers to a very specific a framing of what it means to be critical as an architect, and I think that we need to... We need to redefine what it means to be critical, and it's not the same criticality. I mean,
no, but I mean, do you? I mean, still at the same time, do you?
I also don't know whether there's an outside. I mean, what does it mean to be inside or?
Well,
outside
no, but an outside has been kind of practiced in the sense that I mean, that a specific point in time, there was a position that especially academia in the U.S. took, which
right.
was
but
completely,
then you're in
completely separating themselves yeah. from actually the production of an
right.
environment or built environment
right.
and putting out the critical position. That's I have an issue with that, but at the same time, I'm also I mean I would hope that there is the possibility to actually be critical and like be able to
yeah,
like
yeah.
Or be understanding and like find a critical position within, and that's what I mean within, which is not a complete separation into a critical academia and like kind of a world of architectural production, which has lost any sort of ability to work with or think that way or work the way. So like I think
right, but it is I mean, but it's our generation, the wider definition of our generation's mistrust of labels or groups or right. I mean, I think that
yeah, but I mean, because also I because I've been so heavily labeled in the U.S. I mean,
yeah.
nowhere.
But it's also you
that.
Have to uncover what they are labeling and
yeah.
then realize that it's a very specific context and a very specific definition of,
right.
the, of the critical, and that there are many. Again,
yeah.
it's like you have to. We haven't articulated what other ways are, but I'm sure we will. I mean,
yeah. I mean, I would be. It's kind of like I would be very happy to formulate our practice critically as long as it fits our practice. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, if we really found one which resonates and which allows us to kind of
be productive in the world and not
right.
against the world. And
right.
I mean, to be outside of the world and be inside academia, I mean, well, first of all, it's like anyway, and that, you know, that boundary is also questionable for us
But I think we don't miss it in our day-to-day, right? We miss it within that larger dialogue or discourse
mm-hmm.
within architecture, right? And at school, but
it's
obviously it's not... I don't feel like it's hampering our development as architects.
I think it's about how you articulate what you're doing.
Right.
I mean, that's for me what it means to be critical. But, you know... You may not be ready, or we are not ready.
But the critics aren't ready.
Yeah,
didn't
I also.
They step up
yeah,
first.
Yeah, I also feel like it's not a problem. It's a problem. It's more a problem with architectural criticism than it is a problem with architecture. I mean, that's my other is that the crisis is not within architecture as much as it is within architectural criticism. And criticism has been in crisis in art. I mean, you know. For a long time now, and
but you don't see the, I mean, the strong divide. I mean, what's your position on this relative? I mean, from an outsider's perspective, a really strong divide between a practicing architecture world in the U.S. and the academic world. I mean, it's, I mean, in contextualizing, it's very different than
right.
in other places.
Right.
And
that's what I mean.
I mean.
It was a specific time, a specific moment, specific people.
But it's still real, right?
No, I think we are trying to bridge that gap.
Yeah.
And
no, no. I understand, and I think that's like in the background for you know of architects here.
It is still real within
yeah.
the academic world.
Yeah, that's what
within architecture.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the thing is, we now at Princeton we're starting to, and of course Princeton, you know, has a lot of baggage, just more than other places. But we are starting to meet people in other departments.
Mm-hmm.
And it's clear that in other departments...
They've
you know,
evacuated those...
They,
yeah.
yeah, they're completely done with close reading and, you know, kind of
referencing this to this to this to that. What is the term for it? I don't know, but I can't remember what she said.
Yeah, I know. I think
you know, but I mean, there. So you know, like in the Black Studies department, for example, they're really now engaged in the world and engaged in thinking about Trenton,
right.
for example, and entrepreneurship and things. Whereas you know, I think 10 years ago, it would have been about kind of rereading. Mm-hmm. Invisible Man through the lens, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. So, like always, architecture is behind the times.
Not 20 years, though.
Yeah.
Let me see what's left.
How about one more?
Yeah, one more.
But in LA, I imagine in the academic world, there's a more relaxed. I mean, it's IR. It's got to be. It can't be the kind of hand wringing that we get at Princeton.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not really familiar. I mean, I'm familiar yeah. with Princeton from hearsay, but not
right.
too much.
Yeah.
Well, this one is loaded, but I'll give it a try. How can architects maintain their relevancy during crisis, specifically environmental and or economical? What role, if any, did the profession play in the current housing or environmental crisis? How do we continue to be productive without purely escaping into paper architecture or theory and without completely abdicating responsibility for large-scale mediation of the planet?
Probably I would reformulate a little bit, just like instead of like yeah. remain, but actually become again. I mean,
right.
because, I mean, probably also because we didn't have another opportunity, but I personally see as, I mean, we've lost the projects, yes, but at the same time, I feel this is a great opportunity in the larger picture. And I wonder if in 5 or 10 years we look back to it and actually see kind of a clearing in terms of content being produced and also in sort of like a focus and setup and kind of, I think we talked about it a little bit earlier. So I think in that in terms of the economic crisis, so I hope for this to be actually quite positive. Mm-hmm. And the way, like, how we deal with it, first of all, I think, quite honestly, I mean, I think we're really well prepared in a sense because we've never been well off financially. We've never, I mean, it's like, what should I say? I mean, yeah. I wouldn't fool anybody if I would say, yes, we are. And, especially, I mean, also in Germany, I mean, architecture has been in the worst for years now. I mean, it's gotten a little bit better, but when I graduated 2004, it was, I mean, you couldn't go any lower than, I mean, a whole nation of interns, basically.
Right.
And so I think that in that sense, we're well prepared. But at the same time, I think, again, like something that also came up earlier in the talks, the idea of, with Benjamin, the idea actually that we use that to rethink our position, you know, the idea of the service model, he mentioned that. So we're doing that, for example, through the taking a product route. I mean, even or taking the house as beyond the normally come delivery models. So again, that's like something to maybe it opens up possibilities again. And I think that's why I consider it more like a challenge than anything. And the environmental question. God, that's a really difficult one. It's such a huge topic.
Maybe you leave it on that because I think it's an optimistic
yeah.
note at least.
Yeah.
Great.
Well, we just did this project, which outside the office again, it cannot be off record, but anyway, no, actually, just because it might get too long, but which was actually an optimistic outlook on climate change, and like actually LA, and that's again my outsider, it's like I've never come across a place, I mean, of being so optimistic through on the topic of being challenged in a way. And so there was like from... it's actually not on the website. It's called Hollywood Hills 2100 and inhabiting design. And the point being is that there's from the Jet Propulsion, there's the laboratory, there's the a set of rough climate data out there for LA, basically proposing that the summers are going to be even hotter, the winters are going to be more rainy, which in terms of what the climate conditions of LA is, it means more mudslides in the winter and more wildfires in the summer. And the zone being affected by it is the Hollywood Hills, basically, or at least one zone that's affected by it.
obviously that's a rough reading, but I mean, saying, okay, we take that as a given for a second. We looked into the, there's the whole zone, we labeled it through the 90068 zip code, but which would suddenly not be inhabitable in that sense, in the way it is right now. But I felt there's like something, and that's why the LA optimism comes in, which was called the Trinity of LA, which is three things at the same time. The one being like an almost a close to paradisical natural condition, and then the second part again, and talking of nature, talking of anything, but then the idea of bringing that to a to a moment of perfection in a way. I mean, you know, you see that in the way the human body is treated. You see it in the way kind of these front lawns are treated. Everything is like brought to this momentary moment of perfection, not questioning like what that entails on the longer end of things, and then the ability, obviously, through the as a media, as a place of television, and so actually to portray, to distribute this image of perfection to the rest of the world, and so taking that as a starting point, there was like the idea of actually. And I don't know how well I can actually portray it to just words.
I need
the image. So the Hollywood Hills sign actually is replaced through like a 40-fold scale of it, and all the buildings that are right now inhabiting the hill are actually within the sign, which is everybody wants to live close to the sign anyway. So now you inhabit the sign. The hill is cleared, and you clearly separate in a way like the opposite of any tendency always of hybridizing things. You completely separate them off in a way, and just the idea of like, is there any? I mean, I can, the way I at least saw like the way, or we in that case saw the way the LA would confront or react to this would again be through this kind of positivism or positivist attitude, which I mean, you know, obviously you wouldn't find in the German psyche, right? Yeah. And so, and that's again, like, I like that as the, again, it's something offered if you go to a place like that. So anyway, I could deliver a positive note on that one too.
Sounds good. Okay, thank you.
Great. So I guess that was wrong, but actually, it's